welcome to the last episode of the Mentally Chill podcast in the year 2018 and beyond. What do I mean by that? I don't mean to scare you. Welcome to the show. I'm your host, Kristen Carney. And if you follow me online or the podcast online, you may have seen a post that looked kind of ominous, but then turned out to be totally the opposite. And that was announcing that I'm no longer going to be doing the Mentally Chill podcast. However, I will still be doing a podcast very close to the Mentally Chill podcast, just slightly different. I'm going to read you what I posted on the Patreon page because I can't say it better than how I wrote it, because when I wrote it, I wasn't anxious. And right now, because I'm coming to terms with this decision, I'm very anxious, so it's easier for me to just read it. So here it is. As of late, I've gotten criticism for not being educated in the field of mental health. The pressure of trying to be what people expect of someone talking about mental health, and the pressure I put on myself to say everything just right each episode, has proven too much for me to handle. It's ironic that my show about mental health is damaging my mental health. As you guys know, I'm not an expert on this topic, nor have I ever claimed to be. I mean, that's pretty obvious in the way I discuss things, because I have no idea what I'm talking about. But my goal when starting the show was to quote unquote talk shit about depression. That's it. However, the show has evolved since Stevie's suicide into something with much more gravity than ever originally intended. Due to this, the show is no longer bringing me joy. Instead, intense anxiety, crippling self-doubt, and occasionally tears. I know, big surprise. With that being said, I will still be doing the podcast, but more on my terms. I'll be rebranding it into Kristen and Chill, still with the parentheses over ILL. And it's a play on Netflix and Chill. But I'm not going to be doing it or getting sexy, unfortunately. But we'll still be talking about mental health. It just won't be so heavily emphasized. There will be a segment called Mentally Chill, and many of the ones that I'm already doing, along with some new ones that are a little bit more broad. My goal is to just not attract listeners who are expecting a serious discussion about mental health, rather a fun, lighthearted discussion of the troubles we face daily as delicate humans, along with some other shit that I find funny and relatable. I'm at a very fragile place in my life, and I need to proceed with the utmost caution so that I have a chance at a future, because the way things are going at the moment, I don't think I have much of one. I hope you'll stick with me through this journey, but I understand if you decide otherwise. As usual, I'm so grateful for your support, and I'm excited to bring you a show that both you and I will be able to enjoy. Love always, Mother. It's Mother because you guys are my children, if you didn't know that. So what that means is essentially same show, different name, not as heavy on the serious shit. I'm not here to be an educator. I'm here to have fun and to connect with people. And that's how I wanted it to be at the beginning. And going into 2019, I need to be much more true to myself. And that is step one. And step two is openly admitting that I listen to the Phantom of the Opera soundtrack at least 4 times a week. And I'm okay with it. I'm just starting 2019 in an honest place. So with that being said, I'll take a couple weeks off, maybe 3, so I can get a new logo and figure out how the show is actually going to go. And once I do that, I will be back, and I hope you'll be here too. Again, it's going to be me and pretty much the same old shit. I just don't want people to take it as seriously as they've been taking it. My background is in comedy, not in advocacy, so I'm going to stick with what I know and try to do something good while I do what I know. But also something not so good, because it's just going to be fun. Not everything has to be good. So that's my spiel on what's happening in 2019. Just so you know, I will still be on Patreon doing updates, etc., until I revamp the show and get it back on the air in a couple of weeks. And if you guys want to find me there, you totally can. I'll be updating, getting input from people and ideas from people and suggestions. And big shout out to the new Patreon subscribers, Heather F. and Jeff S. And welcome back, Gregoire. Thank you for making the page fancy again. And for this last, technically last episode of the Mentally Chill podcast, I thought I would bring it full circle and end with a guest who can talk all about suicide prevention, since that is how I lost my co-host. So I have Dennis Gillen on, who speaks publicly about suicide prevention and mental health advocacy after losing his two brothers to suicide. Dennis is awesome and has dedicated his life to this stuff. So please listen to what he has to say. And I hope you guys have a great New Year's Eve and a wonderful start to your 2019 year. And I will see you in a few weeks where we Kristen and chill. Enjoy the show.
Today I went down to a homeless shelter in Columbia, South Carolina, where we do a mental wellness. We used to call it suicide prevention, and nobody would come because the S word was in there.
Yeah.
And I had some advice. Someone said, why do you call it a wellness roundtable or a mental health roundtable? So we ended up with mental wellness. Put the word suicide in there, people walk away.
Yeah.
But if you think about suicide prevention, you go upstream and you talk to folks who have a mental health condition. If we take care of the mental health aspect, maybe we will reduce the number of suicides.
Who are the people attending the wellness event?
Residents. And part of being a resident, you have a caseworker, and a caseworker will ask you to attend classes. Now, volunteers from the community come in and will give classes like resume writing. They do a better start, like on a drug rehab kind of thing. And ours is a mental wellness. And when they're done, at the end of the day, they slide their papers over to me and I sign them so they could tell their caseworker and show them that they're putting the effort forth to make themselves a better person by attending these classes. So it's kind of cool.
Are they kind of doing it as a teenager would, to just be like, yeah, I did it, I showed up, and then go back to their own thing? Or are they actually really dedicated to getting better?
I think probably both, but the most part for this class is such a tough topic. If you don't want to go, you know, there's other classes you could take that would be easier. You know, we're going to talk mental wellness, and it's going to be me pointing at you going, what do you think? And facilitating like a peer-to-peer mentorship program. So I like to think that people come because they want to, but I'm sure I signed some papers and people were just there to punch, you know, the ticket. But the silver lining is hopefully they got one or two pearls out of it.
Yeah, I'm sure they did. More than they are aware of at this current juncture, I'm sure.
Exactly.
Like down the road, they might go, oh, I was at that wellness. What do you call it? I keep saying wellness.
Mental wellness.
Okay, I was at the mental wellness program, and boom, all of a sudden I had an epiphany of what Dennis said. And he was so right, and it makes so much sense. And, I think that happens to me where things don't really hit me until they need to hit me. And then they hit me hard.
Oh, yeah. At the right time, at the right moment. Exactly. The message lands. And actually, we had that at the shelter one day. This guy came up to me and goes, hey, one day I was walking by this guy and he looked like he was doing so hot. And remember, you went over all those warning signs and all that stuff. I said, yeah. He goes, so I went up and started talking to him. And it was so cool to hear his story and to see his face light up, because you truly do get whatever you want in life if you help others get what they want. And it was really cool to see this guy. So he just needed a cigarette. So I turned to the group there. I said, anyone have a cigarette for this guy? And instead of, you know, one cigarette, we had 20 cigarettes, because they want to help each other. It's just this whole community, and it made my heart.
Yeah, it's funny helping someone with cigarettes. It's a good gesture, but also like in the long run, a horrible gesture.
Yeah.
He'll give you cancer. He'll give you
it's
cancer.
Horrible.
He'll give you cancer. Oh, we can all give you cancer. Here's 20 cancers.
Who's got a cancer stick for my buddy here? No, but it was what he needed at that moment.
Yeah, it's the camaraderie.
The camaraderie. And they rallied. Instead of one, he ends up with like a pack. So it's kind of cool.
I love that. The sweetest way to get sick.
Nice.
So we've tried to tape this several times. You and I have talked about rallied. We have rallied to get this podcast done on the airwaves, sounding good. And so this is our take five of trying to do this. But I'm using this for the audience as an example of perseverance. If you try and try, eventually it'll work out. And thank you for trying, you know, for sticking with this.
Well, I think we both learned a lesson from yesterday with the technical difficulties. You and I have both been through a lot, and suicide's touched our lives. So the thing yesterday, it didn't bother me at all. It was just one of those things like, you know what, let's try this another day. It could have ruined both our days. It, you know, I didn't carry it. The minute we hung up and said, we'll try tomorrow, I was fine with it. It's amazing when you've gone through a lot of stuff in your life, how some of the little stuff, you gain strength. You know, if I could survive what I survived, this is definitely not going to bother me.
Yeah, but how come that happened for you and not for me? I'm still affected by the smallest things. I get so freaked, even though I know in the big picture it's nothing.
Oh, because maybe it's because I'm an old fart. No, I'm. Yeah. It comes with wisdom. That's a beautiful thing. I wish I had all this wisdom when I was younger, like your age. But I wasn't going to let it bother me. You and I, yeah. I always look for signs. Well, if we try something that's not working out, you know, maybe another day.
And you are an old fart, I will say that, but I am just a fart.
Yeah, so that's it. That's all.
I would rather be an old fart because at least there's an excuse to be a fart.
Yeah, that's right.
So tell everyone your story and how you ended up becoming a speaker on suicide prevention and mental health. We used to do this, Stevie and I, as a sob story where we'd tell our background and it would be our quote unquote sob story. And if ever there was a sob story, it's this one you're about to tell. And I know you don't wallow in it, and you have a very strong, positive outlook, but what you went through was very dramatic. And so I want you to give us the lowdown on your past.
Sure. And probably the reason yesterday didn't bother me, it was because of what I went through with my two brothers. I'm one of five kids. I'm right in the middle. Sheila, Mark, Dennis, me in the middle, Janice and Matthew. And in 1983, my older brother, Mark, who battled depression for years, the disease state won, and he died by suicide. And I always try to say, don't ever say it can't get any worse, because it can. 11 years later, when we thought we were doing okay, so I get out of college, I get married, I'm living in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, when the phone rings again, and it's bad news. It's my younger brother, Matthew, in a drunken stupor with access to lethal means, 11 years after Mark dies, decides to follow Mark, and he dies by suicide. So of the three guys that were in the family, there's one left, me, and my two sisters. So you mentioned wallowing. I wallowed for a long time, and I had to do some self-healing, and not even self-healing. I had to go see a professional at that point. You know, and it prompted me to sober up and go see a professional. Those two things working for me. And years later, I started telling the story. And somebody, one time I did it, I told a story about my brothers after not telling anybody. I would go to, you know, people would ask me how many kids in my family. I'd say, oh, there's three of us, me and my two sisters. I wouldn't even mention Mark and Matthew. Wouldn't even mention them. And then one day at a fundraiser for a walk we did for the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, I was asked to tell my story, and I told it. And I sat down, I just took 5 minutes, and I sat down, and later someone came up to me and said, you need to tell that story more often. I remember sitting there going, no, I'm done.
Yeah,
it's
like, hell no, that is so exhausting.
Oh, it wore me out. But then more and more people came up and said, that was really impactful. And then I got invited to speak at a university where I live, in University of South Carolina. And I didn't do so good, but they enjoyed it. I was crying the whole time. I cried the whole time.
If you cried, that means you did do well. Just so you know.
Yeah, they said I made it human, but I cried the whole time. I mean, it wasn't even like a little tear. I mean, bawling, snot, the whole ball of wax, the headache. Every time I cry, I get a headache. Well, they had a box of tissues. They slid them to me and said, hey, you know. It was, thank God, it was these psychology interns. So it was, you know, these, I think they were doctoral candidates in psychology. So they kind of knew what I was going through, or I wasn't the first person they saw that dealt with a significant trauma, but they were so understanding, and thank goodness it was a small group. It was like a horseshoe table, about eight of them. And I spoke there, cried. I spoke at College of Charleston, only cried half the time. And then I spoke at another school, and I didn't really cry that much. This is the beginning when I go over my brothers. And then it went from that eight to, I mean, one time at Cornell, I think there was 1,000 kids in the room.
I cry at Cornell because I wouldn't have been able to get in there. I would have just been intimidated by all the smart people.
That's actually how I opened up at Cornell. I was supposed to come here and play lacrosse, but turns out my grades weren't that good and I'm a crappy lacrosse player. Those two factors. So here I am. I made it there. Took a long route, but I'm back. And now you're going to listen to me, you little punks. No, they're awesome. No, they're awesome. And that's kind of when I hit my stride, I think, with that.
So when you're telling your story, you know, are you giving advice or is it more story?
Oh, well, Kristen, great question. What I'm trying to do is instill hope. So, and reduce the number of suicides. So what I use my story, but it's not about me. I talk about my brothers really briefly in the beginning because it's brutal. For me, more for the audience. Says, listen, we just got to get through these next couple slides. Please give me grace. I'm not a psychiatrist. I'm not a psychologist, but this happened. You know, I was studying accounting at the time. So I said, this happened. So we go through it. And then we quickly transition to what I did to get better, what you all can do. Now I'm focusing on the audience. I said, this is what you can do. And I go over positive coping skills, warning signs, if your friend's downward spiraling, what to look for, and it may be you. So it really, it's not the Dennis Gillen story per se. I use my story to catapult this message of, you know, hope and social connection, what I did to get better, and the hopes that someone out there is listening and they're trying to get better. So
yeah, when we talked a couple of weeks ago, I loved an analogy you made or a reference you made to being like a matchstick or like a stick, and you can't break if you're in a bundle or something.
Oh, that's a great analogy. A stick alone can be broken by a child, but a stick in a bundle cannot be broken.
Even by like the best martial artist.
Exactly. If you get a big enough bundle. I did this talk one time at a CrossFit gym, and I brought up the owner of the gym, and I said, Tanya, break this. And she broke the single stick, and I handed her the bundle. I said, break this. And she's a very fit woman. She's like, I can't do it. Said, exactly. And the point is, bundle up. We're not meant to go through this thing called life alone. But often when we're in a mental health crisis or situation, we want to be alone, which is, it works counterintuitive to what we need. We need to be in a bundle. And we ended up withdrawing and isolating, myself included. After Matthew died, I pulled away from all my friends. Thank goodness they were persistent and kept pursuing me. So part of that talk is like, listen, if you're in the bundle and you see one of the sticks break away, go after them. Go after them.
Right.
Bundle. Go chase that stick down. And stick, be receptive if the bundle comes up to you. So the point is, bundle up. Like, join a club. Join an organization. Do something.
But it's so hard to do that when you are depressed and just want to be that single stick.
Oh,
how do you force yourself to do it? That's the hardest part.
It's work. That's a great point. It is absolute work. Having been there myself, I went through a divorce not too long ago and moved to a new town. Oh, you know, talk about isolating. Small single apartment from a big old house. And one day I got on that program. It's called Meetup. It sounds like a hookup site, but it's for hobbyists, whatever, hiking.
You showed up naked and you're like, well, I thought this was a hookup. We're actually hiking. Shit.
Oh yeah. I forgot my boots. Yeah. And I forced myself to go on that hike with these people that I did not know. And they were awesome. They're awesome people. And it's good to be out in nature where you feel small, but it was, I'm telling you, for the introverts of the world, it was work.
Did you hit a point where you were just so low that the only place to go was up? And by up, I mean into a group.
One of it became like this whole mindfulness. I was self-aware of like, oh, this is not good. This is not good being alone. This is not good. So because of the work I do, and you start, you know, the mindfulness, I was like, all right, I know I'm alone. I know what I'm doing. I'm sleeping too much. All the warning signs were there. Like, Dennis, you're going into a funk. Quick. What do you do to get out of the funk? And this is why you should have a personal safety plan. Because I look at my plan and go, uh-oh, get in front of people. How do I do that? Go hiking. I like to hike. Go in the woods. Who do I go with? Hey, there's a club. So it was, trust me, there was a couple hikes I signed up and didn't go on.
Yeah.
But finally, I broke down and went. And I get in a car and we drive up to the beautiful hills of Western North Carolina. And I just had to, you know, I left the house at 8. I got home at 5 and I was exhausted.
Whoa, that's a legit hike.
Oh, these people are the real deal.
I would have assumed you were murdered or something if I was at home waiting for you.
Well, here's the thing about the divorce. Nobody was waiting for me.
Right.
So I had that going for me. Yeah. But the hike was good and beneficial. So for all the introverts out there in the world, it's work, and I get it. So this meetup has all kinds of stuff. If you like to write, there's a writing club, photo, you know, photography, all kinds of stuff on there, no matter what you fancy.
Quick question about that, though, is were the people there people that you would want to really hang around?
These people were wonderful, and that's part of the beautiful thing about being a mental health advocate. I've fallen in love with people again. But the thing is, when you go on these meetups, just remember, you're going to say, wow, this is probably a bunch of misfits. And then you say to yourself, well, I hope they have room for one more because I'm a misfit.
Right.
So there I was going, God, I hope they accept me, you know, so, and they did. Yeah. And then plus you're hiking. So you're out in nature and you feel small. And at the end of the day, everyone had a story. So it was well worth it. It was work though. I'm not going to lie to your listeners and say, wow, that was easy. No, it wasn't easy. I drove, had to get in a parking lot. We all met in this parking lot. near McDonald's and introduce yourself. But once you get the
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. It's just the effort. It just seems like so much mental effort, but it's worth it because it helped you, because I know that you said you were struggling with alcohol. And
yeah, I was
like
heading
that.
South. I was heading south and I knew it. The struggle with alcohol.
If you're heading south, just like into like a southern state, there's problems.
Mentally, I was heading south and I'm in South Carolina, but mentally I could tell when I'm heading south, you know, looking at my own symptoms is, you know, I'm sleeping, sleep's disturbed. You mentioned drinking. We ended up in a pub. I don't drink, but I drove. So it's after my younger brother died, I did one really smart thing. I got hammered the night of his funeral, but I haven't touched the stuff since. And that was, again, for my own self-preservation. I was going through some stuff, and this is what I talk about in my talk, and I throw it back in the audience. I said, listen, I know I can't go from college to college going, hey, kids, don't drink. Like, beat it, Grandpa. I got it.
Yeah.
But if you're going through something mentally, all I ask is that you go through it sober. That's all I ask. And then you could always, I always thought I'd come back to drinking when I got better, but then I fell in love with sobriety. So next year, Kristen, and this is kind of weird for an Irish guy, but next year I will celebrate 25 years of sobriety, which is kind of sad too, because that means 25 years Matthew was gone. I got drunk the night of his funeral, and I haven't touched it since. So it's a bittersweet anniversary.
It is. Well, it's amazing that you have kept that up, and I really applaud you, because that's like, you've been boring for 25 years, and I don't mean that in a awful way. I just mean it's like, you know, it's hard to be okay being in reality all the time.
Nobody has more fun than me though when we go to parties. I fell in love with sobriety. It's not like a death wish. It's awesome.
But did you really, like, did you really fall in love?
I do. I love it.
I'm kind of calling
bullshit. No, I love it.
Everybody, but it does seem like a little bit of a cult.
No, it's a personal decision. No, not me. It's a personal decision. I drove three drunks to go see Notre Dame play Boston College when I lived in Chicago. I drove them down there and drove them back. I got home at midnight. They were hammered. I had a ball. I didn't sit there and go, you know, I really shouldn't drink that alcohol. No, my job was to drive and get them home safe. And I did. And I got home that night at midnight. And I said, what a day that was. It was awesome. So it depends. I know what you're saying. There are some people, well, you know, they'll look at you judgmentally. Not me. I'll belly up the bar. I'll buy a round. But my round will include at least one Diet Coke for me. I love going out. I'm going out tonight. My kids are in town. I'm going out tonight to see them somewhere. But I'll get a club soda with a lime and just chill.
Have you always been uninhibited? Because I think that takes a special person to be like, yeah, I'll go out and party and be totally sober the whole time.
Oh, no. It's a learned. You know, there were a couple when I first started, stopped drinking and sobered up. You know, there's a couple of days. I thought there were a couple of friends I had to avoid, or, you know, they come around. Your true friends come around. And I remember I celebrated like 10 years sober. One of my buddies goes, dude, I didn't give you a week.
You should text him on the 25th anniversary.
Oh yeah. I'm going to have a kegger on my 25th, but we'll have one keg of root beer for me.
Well, so when we spoke before, we talked a little bit more about your family and their response and how you guys didn't really speak about it. And because people listening have no idea that we've already talked about this like several times, but to rehash it with you and I, but first time for people listening, tell me a little bit about the way your family dealt with it. And I think people get very disappointed that their family doesn't talk more about mental health, but it's so common. And so even after a tragedy like what you went through and your family went through, you guys really still didn't talk about it until the second occurrence happened.
Great, great memory there, Kristen. When Mark died, I remember, I'm speaking for me, everyone's different. You know, my sisters have different reactions. My parents have different reactions. But when Mark died, we just, sometimes pride gets in the way. We just didn't talk about it. I remember when I left school was a Thursday to go home and do the funeral. I was back on campus on Tuesday. So Friday, Saturday, you know, Monday, I'm back. So we just marched on.
Yeah.
And it's terrible. You know, we weren't processing it. Looking back, maybe I should have took the semester off. Maybe we should have rallied. Who knows? Hindsight is 2020. And looking back, I didn't handle it very well. That's when I really upped my drinking. So, miscellaneous drug use. We'll leave it at that. So partied hard and, you know, we lost Matt and still didn't talk about it so much, but through this mental health advocacy work that I do and stuff that's come around, and we started talking about the boys again and telling the funny stories. And it was at one of the walks in New York when I went back home and did a walk, and my dad came, my mom was there, cousins and everything else. And we just started sharing stories about the boys again, you know, telling the funny stuff.
And this is what, 20 years later?
Golly, yeah. We just bottled it up.
Did you ever see your mother crying or your father crying and they didn't know you saw them, or did you just see them not react really at all?
No, that was the shocker with the older brother was when I went home from school and I walked in the house. I expected to see everyone cry. I didn't expect to see my dad crying. And you just don't expect that. And I saw him crying, and that really set me off. But I think we're still guarded in a sense. You know, we start talking about it, and then someone will well up with tears, and then we'll just stop, you know, out of courtesy for that person.
So there was emotion surrounding it, just not discussion.
Yeah, there's always emotion. And as we get older and wiser, we talk more about it.
I'm not trying to say, oh, good, you guys had emotion, but I think it's better than not seeing anyone have any reaction really at all. I think that would really scare me as a kid if, you know, I didn't see anyone really crying or really going through emotions over this. And so I understand the lack of discussion, and I didn't really understand the lack of emotions. But since you're just saying there were emotions, you know, I feel like that was at least a little therapeutic.
When I do the talk on stage, and it happened a couple times, when I get to the slide and I go over my brothers real quick, we don't dwell on that. We go over to, you know, quickly on the message of hope. But when I have to go over my brothers, I remember one time I went over the slide of Matthew, and it just hit me that day. My grief was just hit me hard. And I remember looking at the slide, and I got real quiet. You can hear my voice now. I just remember it. Like I had a moment on stage, and it was so quiet. Those kids were so respectful. I remember sitting there going, Dennis, you better start talking because you're on stage and it's really quiet right now. And I came back. I said, all right, guys, I'm back. And I appreciate that. But they were so, one guy said, you know, after the talk, he said, just to see that emotion on stage really helped. And like, I didn't mean it, but just, it got me. That day just got me.
Well, I say this all the time that I see people as empty shells and emotionless beings. And when I see someone cry, I love it in a not I'm happy they're crying way, but in a, oh my God, they're human way. And so I think that's why, like you said, you know, the first time you spoke about it and you cried and cried and cried, people said you did great. It's because someone can really connect to that. But when you're just stone cold and just blah, 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 you know, and you can get to that point, of course, because you've been doing this for a long time, but you know, if I saw you cry, I would immediately want to just hug you and take you home and be best friends, you know? And so I think the crying is so important for other people to see. Not that people should be crying in public all the time, like maniacs, but you know.
It's the tears of sadness that make you appreciate, you know, the belly laughs. So you have to have them. It's interesting. I often worry about that, Kristen. Like, am I going to get to the point where I do this presentation? Oh, there's my older brother Mark. He died. Oh, and then my younger brother Matt died. Blah, blah. And so far, it hasn't happened. When I get to those slides, I could hear it. I tell the audience, like, you could hear my voice. You know, it just cracked. I said, I know what's coming.
Yeah.
I know what's coming.
But do you now? I'm saying, well, I'm kind of going the opposite direction. But in my experience with Stevie, I have moments where I am totally stone cold about it. Like right now in this moment, I'm not going to well up. I'm not going to feel anything. And I know it's a defense mechanism. Then something will happen, or, you know, I'll get into a certain state of mind and just start bawling.
Yeah.
And so have you kind of gone numb though at certain moments?
No, it's weird. I've always been a sentimental fool. And I worried about that one time. I was about to give this presentation to this huge group of sorority women at a national meeting. And I woke up that day. I had just given it the week before. I did back-to-back weekends, like Saturday, Saturday. And I'm like, I'm not feeling it. Like, and I was really worried about it. Like, am I going to get to that point? So on my laptop, I went into this file I have, I said, pictures of brothers. And I went in there and I started looking at pictures again. And all of a sudden, all the emotions came back. I'm like, oh, I still feel it. You know, like, I'm so worried about that, Chris. And that's a great question. And I bet you, if you were doing a talk with Stevie about Stevie, and you're on stage and you're just talking about, you're in a panel, it'd be fine. But then if you had a picture of Stevie behind you and you turned and looked, like one of my last presentations, I changed the picture of my little brother Matthew, and I can remember the shirt he was wearing, the New York Rangers, and I changed it, and I turned to look at the slide, and I forgot I changed my own picture, my own slide, and it got me. It absolutely got me. I'm like, son of a, I just look, son of a bitch. And I turned to the audience and said, sorry, I forgot I changed the picture. I forgot. And I remember that shirt. I remember that smell of that shirt.
Yeah, struck you. So, okay, I want to talk practicalities, which I normally don't do, but I really want you to fill us in on, like, you know, how the suicide rates have gone up, signs to look for, and stuff like that.
Sure, absolutely. Unfortunately, on the suicide rate issue, we're at almost every category is heading in the wrong direction. When I first started talking about suicide prevention in the United States, we lost about 38,000 people that year to suicide. The latest data set came out, and we're over 47,000.
Wow.
Folks.
Wow.
It's terrible. It's almost like a jumbo jet falling.
How many years ago was that?
That was only 8 years ago, 2010. So it's gone up like 10,000 roughly. Yeah. And we're just, everything seems to be trending in the wrong direction. So the struggle is real. It's real, and we have to increase our efforts, and needs to be more people out there. We do need more psychologists and psychiatrists. That's a fact, because when I go see my personal psychologist and she says, hey, I want you to see the psychiatrist, I said, sure, you know, maybe we're heading down a path, we want to try something else. When I go to book an appointment with the psychiatrist, and this happened as early, as recent as last year, he was 6 weeks out. 6 weeks.
Wow.
And it's just because there's not enough of them. So,
or just because they're lazy. Take more appointments, psychiatrists.
Exactly.
Nah. Fill up your day. I want you 23 hours out of 24 hours a day listening to people's problems.
You don't need to sleep. We do. Yeah.
No, you don't. You're not also a person. I would love to actually have a therapist come on and do confessions of a therapist or confessions of a psychiatrist, because when you're in there talking about yourself, you know, you forget that there's a human being behind that pad of paper. And I've always wondered what they feel like, and if they feel left in the dust, and if people don't really care about how they're doing and that kind of stuff. But that's for another day. So why do you think the rates are going the wrong direction?
That's like the million-dollar question. I think for some reason, society, I can go on a whole social media thing and all that stuff. I just don't think we're getting along very well at the moment. And we need to be kinder.
Do you think it is social media and the internet? That's what I think.
Oh, I think there's a huge play in that. Watching, my own screen time, we end up going on Instagram and comparing our lives to everyone else's. And like, hold on, that's everybody on their best day. That's their highlight reel. You know, nobody's posting on there, hey, I didn't get out of bed till, 12:30 today because I'm depressed. No,
except me. I keep shit real.
Yeah, you're being real, Kristen. I appreciate that. You're being real.
Except I won't really, for the most part, post an ugly selfie. I will only post my highlight reel of selfies, like that one in a million selfie that turns out well. But in terms of being honest about shit not going well, I do try to keep it real, and I hope people follow suit.
I see a trend in that. I do. I see a trend in that. I see people, and that's who you tend to follow.
Well, I'm a trendsetter.
You are. You're a trendsetter. You're leading the way. But I do see people getting more real. Maybe it's the people I follow. And now there's another OCD called obsessive comparative disorder, where you go online and see everyone's life is awesome. Why are they on a cruise? And I'm home mowing the lawn. It's. I don't think it's good. I don't think it's good. And I'm going to limit my screen time in 2019 for real, for my own mental health. I've taken Twitter breaks. I've deleted it off my phone.
Yeah. My big step was moving Twitter and Instagram to the last page of my iPhone. And I'm that lazy that I thought, I'm not going to want to swipe several times to get to these apps. I'll definitely go on it less. And what was actually surprising was that apparently I'm much harder working than I thought, because I'm willing to swipe those few swipes to get to these apps, but it didn't help at all. And, it was a feeble attempt, but it wasn't.
I would have to delete it. I'm with you, because I would find it, or you just hit, search and find it. I'm going to have to delete Twitter, I think. But I think, because I get on there and I get off and I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm in such a bad mental state because of that. Why am I doing this to myself? So
what's interesting is that on Instagram, it's everyone's highlight reel, how great you're doing, how wonderful you're doing. But then on Twitter, it's everyone's honest reel. Like most people post that I follow anyway, but it's generally like, this shit went wrong today, or here's a funny joke complaint. And so it's interesting how they have taken on total opposite. I mean, Twitter is still braggy in a sense because you could be posting how bad you're doing, but then it gets 5 million likes and then it becomes a highlight reel in a weird way, even though it's a negative thing. The negative thing is now, you know, getting attention. So in your brain, it becomes positive. And it's so weird. And I've talked on this podcast many times about how we're the guinea pigs for this internet social media stuff, and the outcome I don't think will be great, just like the outcome for plastics now, you know, incorporated into humankind for the first time
yeah
in the history. It's not going to turn out well. So
it's not going to turn out well, and we may be, Kristen, go full circle here, we may be seeing that in the increase in suicides. Maybe that's the end result. I don't, you know, 78% of all suicides are guys, women have more attempts.
So, okay, so that's interesting. So I had Dr. Drew on the show a few months ago, and he mentioned that they're seeing an increase in suicide among females. Is that correct? Don't tell Dr. Drew I'm questioning his authority.
That is correct.
Okay, so it is going up.
No, he's spot on. Yeah, it was low, and it doesn't take much to get an increase, but it was low to begin with. And then, you know, if you take a low number and double it, it's still a lot. But percentage-wise, yeah, the women have seen their numbers go up.
Yeah, this is like where women want to have a glass ceiling.
That would be fine. Yeah, and that's pretty much what I yell at the guys when I get an all male audience. Sometimes I'll do just these fraternity groups, and I say, I just yell at them. I say, guys, we suck. This is not where we want to lead. You know, 78%, 4 to 5. Come on. You know,
tell me what the signs are to look for. And I feel like some of these are really obvious, but it's weird because they're obvious, but yet you don't see them.
You don't see them. You can hear them. You know, hindsight is 2020. Maybe you saw them and didn't realize what it was. We like to put them in three buckets: talk, behavior, mood. Talk, behavior, mood. If someone's talking about it, this, you guys would be better off without me. You know, I think, you know, there's a text line. You could text 741-741. You could say help. And they've been doing a really good job on that text service of, I guess, data mining and finding some keywords, some words like trapped, burden, pain, unbearable pain. So people talking about it. Mm-hmm. So if you're clued in and people say, I have no reason to live, or you guys would be much better without me. Whoa, 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 whoa. Time out. Let's explore that. You know,
what about people who joke about it? I know growing up, and you know, now because of this podcast and because of Stevie and all sorts of things, I've become much more careful with joking about it. But so many people all the time, this is real life, will be like, oh my God, I'm gonna kill myself. Oh my God. Because you know what? And I'm answering my own question, because I have looked back on some of my first communication with Stevie when we first met. And this was years and years ago. And I knew she had been posting online about depression. And that's why her and I ended up chatting, because I was like, you know, hey, I struggle too. And then we just started a back and forth. And we were talking about starting this podcast years and years ago. And she said, I think I'm done with show business. I think I'm just going to either get my Pilates license or kill myself. And so I didn't really know her that well. I knew she had depression, but in that casual way where someone just throws that out, I was like, oh my God, me too. You know, like when does it cross over into, that probably was for real.
One, for your audience, I think we all can agree that we shouldn't joke about it. That's, you know, especially coming from a guy who lost two brothers, you lost your partner in podcasting. You and I are both on the same page. Let's not even joke about it. But if someone did, was to say that in front of somebody, so now we're giving some practical advice. Say, listen, that's not really that funny. And are you okay? Throw it back to them. Like, you know, that is a warning sign if someone's talking about it. So the Pilates or kill myself, knowing what you and I know now, we wish we knew then. It's like, listen, that second part of that equation, are you okay? Can I help you with anything?
Yeah. Looking back on that, you know, then it's the survivor's guilt. And I'll just touch upon it real quick and then we'll get back to the practical stuff. But, you know, I had the feeling of the wrong one took her life. And I wasn't going to dwell on that. I wasn't going to make it a thing, but that crossed my mind. And it crossed my mind because I thought it, but then it crossed my mind because I thought other people would think it, because Stevie was amazing. And I felt like, you know, people would be going, oh, bummer, wrong one. But then, you know, I did let that go. But what was your experience? Because these were your two brothers. They weren't, and not that it would be any less intense if they were your sisters, but the other two males in your family had decided to make this decision or accidentally made this decision. How did you reflect on yourself?
Oh, like you, when Stevie lost her battle, was I felt extremely vulnerable at that moment. Two guys down, one to go. I'm like, no, this is not a trilogy. No, we're not doing this. So, and suicide comes with its own suitcases or packages of guilt that don't belong there. And you know, we called about, you know, the survivor's guilt. The wrong person died by suicide. I think every time someone dies by suicide, it's the wrong person. I don't want anyone to die by suicide. But I did. I felt this incredible burden, again, self-inflicted. A lot of what you were talking about with Stevie was all, you did it to yourself, and I did it to myself. Like, I'm the last Gillen boy. You know, the name stops with me. At that point, I did not have any sons. I didn't have any kids. We were struggling to get pregnant at the time, and it was, you know, not happening. So when Matthew died, so I was like, all this stuff came burning down. I just felt, I felt extremely vulnerable. And up until that point, so probably 32 years old or so, 30, I felt invincible. Like, I was young. I had every, all my faculties, you know, everything else. I survived the loss of Mark. And then when Matt died, I felt terribly vulnerable. Like, I don't deserve this. I don't, you know, maybe it's, I don't deserve to live, but the pain was just so intense with Matthew, because it's my younger brother. It's just different when it's a younger brother, that I didn't know what to think. At some point, you know, you probably done this. You catch yourself just sighing. I just walk around and go,
oh my God, yes.
All the time. Just can't believe this is my life.
Yeah. I do it almost habitually, where it bothers people, where people are like, are you okay? And I'm like, yeah, I'm okay. I'm not even realizing I'm sighing. It's more like I'm trying to release some tension within me. And I'm just always going,
same here.
And I'll have no idea that I'm doing it. People go, are you mad at me? And I'll say, what? Because what? And they're like, well, you're sighing. And I'm like, oh, I am. Well, I think I'm just trying to just, you know, just be okay, just, or something.
Same thing. I'm thinking about something. So, and yeah, inadvertently, I go, oh, and just like, you know, usually it's the boys that I think about Matt and Mark. I can't believe this. This is not the script I wrote for myself, you know, my life, but it's the one I got dealt. So there is this whole thing called the survivor, suicide survivor's bill of rights. And the first right is like, I have the right to be free of guilt, which is easier said than done. And then the last one, and I'll have to send this to you, maybe we could post it on your website. The last one is, I have the right to be. And I remember after my brother died, Mark, I remember I was at a party and I remember laughing and someone looked at me and I felt all of this guilt, like I shouldn't be laughing. But I have to remember, I have the right to be. I have a life. They had a life. They made an awful decision to end their life way prematurely. And I'm going to ride this thing out as long as I can. And truly believe that I have the right to be. I love to laugh. You know, it's because I've cried so much.
And you know, it's kind of trite or unoriginal, but you know that's what they would want. You know, they would want you to be happy and to be enjoying your life. They wouldn't want you to feel that guilt and that sadness.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I don't think, I can only speculate on this, but someone who dies by suicide probably doesn't think about the pain inflicted on others because they're in so much pain at the moment. And it's our goal as people around them to try to get them through that moment and say, come to the other side and let's work on this, get them into therapy or something. But it's, I don't think they ever think about the grief they cause others. I had to sit next to, I went to these survivor of suicide loss meetings, and they have them, and you, in almost every church and every, you know, area, you could find one, a survivor of suicide loss. I remember sitting there handing tissues to this mother who lost her son. And he had, if you're a boy, and I am, if you make your mama cry, you did something wrong, and she's bawling. And I'm sitting there going, this boy never thought of this. He never thought of this. He never thought his mother would be like this.
Yeah. I mean, every time I've, not that it's that often, but whenever I've had a suicide fantasy or like ideation, immediately think of my mom and my family, but especially my mom. And I would never be able to do that to her. And I have said before, and this isn't not a threat, this is when I've been like very low, but I've said, if something happened to my parents and they were gone from this earth, that's the only time I would really actually ever think I'd consider going through with taking my own life. And I know it sounds really dark, and it's not really meant to be that dark. It's just meant to be honest. And I have a guilt. My entire life, I've had a guilty conscience. Like when I was little and I did something that I wasn't supposed to, I would lie in bed and cry. And then my mom would come in and I'd have to blurt out, like, you know, I took someone's marker and, you know, I forgot to give it back, or I didn't give it back, or something, you know, like the littlest things I'd always feel deep, deep guilt about. And I'm going through that currently with my dog who is sick, and I don't know if I'm keeping him alive in a selfish way or in a caring way, but I have deep, deep guilt associated with what's going on with him right now. And so I just know that if I did take my own life and my mom was still here, I think my soul wouldn't be able to rest because I would feel so awful about what I did that I almost have a fear of my soul being kind of stuck in this, you know, nether world or limbo because of the decision I made. So I basically will not do it, especially if my mother is on this planet. But anyway, was that weird? I feel like that got weird.
No, that's not weird at all. It's just, it's not a good option, Kristen. And I hope you do.
I know. And I know that. No. And I totally know that.
It's just not a good option. I hope you never do, because you'd bum me out as well. So it's, immediate, there's this ripple effect that people don't think about. All these people, you know, they say if one person dies, 25 are affected, you know. So let's take that 40,000 people suicide. That's a million folks who got rocked.
I am so glad you just said that, because as you were talking, I was doing math on my calculator and I didn't know the number of people that were affected by suicide, but I guessed maybe 5 per one suicide. So I did the math while you're talking, and it was 235,000 people affected by suicides in, you know, this year alone. But that's, my math is totally wrong. It's way higher. So it's
way higher
in the millions.
They say six immediate. And then 25, you know, indirect, but it's unbelievable. You just don't think about the people. And I had people coming up to me about my brothers that I didn't even know. They knew my brothers. I said, yeah, we had a class together. That really hurt me. You know, like it did, it hurt them. So not a good option. So we try to look at, you know, other ways to get out of there. And we were talking about the warning signs. So if you put the three in the buckets, the talk, behavior, mood, hopefully your audience will recognize that somebody's heading south. It's also a gut feeling. They say we have three brains, one in our head because of the nerve endings, one in our heart, and one in our gut based on nerve endings. And sometimes you got to go with your gut.
So you know what? Doing this episode is so frustrating because I really wanted to make a penis joke about having a brain in your penis, but we're talking about such a sensitive issue that I'm like, God damn it. I can't really say the things I want to say.
That's classic. It would be perfect.
So we have four brains, or maybe three, because I would guess in a guy, there'd be one in the stomach, one in the penis, and then one, where was the other one besides the actual brain?
The heart.
Okay. Well, yeah, maybe guys have two then. They have two brains.
The brain, the stomach, the heart, and the hard on. No,
yeah, it's totally. Exactly.
But no. We're talking to the gut. What we're talking about when you just, your gut feeling is like something's wrong with my friend. I just hope your audience says something, or you step in before they step out. I'd always like to be embarrassed or something. Like even if I called the cops on my buddy and I thought he was heading south and they got mad at me, I would be like, at least they're mad at me.
Yeah,
at least they're still allowed to be mad at me.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I remember saying to Stevie, and I'm going to now try to backtrack so people don't think I'm actually serious about considering it. But I remember saying to Stevie, shortly before she passed away. It was probably a week or two before when we taped an episode where she talked all about her suicide attempts that we never published, thank God. But I said, if you put it in perspective, the Earth has been around, or this universe has been around, for just gajillion, trillion, bajillion years. And our short 80 years, if we make it that far, is such a blip on the scale. And I know when you're in that deep pain, this pain outweighs the logical side of things. But I said to her, you know, it's just so short that I might as well stick around just to see what happens. Because I'm going to be gone before I know it. And so what's the difference? Why don't I just be in some discomfort if I'm unhappy for 20 years? Because 20 years on the scale of the world is nothing. So I try to kind of put it in that perspective. And I said that to her, and it didn't really register with her. Like, again, it didn't, you know, really hit her. So.
Oh, sure. Yeah. You have to build up some kind of resilience, because, you know, I'm a suicide prevention advocate or mental health advocate. And I'm not going to lie to you, it creeps in my mind every now and then. I'm like, nah. And then you got to chase it out. That's why you build up resilience. We're not immune to those feelings, but we have to build up some defense mechanism going, oh, no, that would be the.
How do you build up resilience?
I think one thing you look at, if you look at what you've already been through and you survived, look, you take strength from what you've been through already, Kristen. You know, there's this thing called, you know, post-traumatic growth. If you survived what you already survived, you should have strength from that. I survived the loss of two brothers to suicide. And I'm telling you, that's why none of the technical difficulties of our podcast bothered me. It just didn't bother me. I didn't let it bother me. Because I, you know, I've seen some stuff. So you build up resilience. And that's why sometimes when you protect somebody from an event, like if, you know, I think about parenting, if you protect your son, he gets in trouble at school and you go and yell at the teacher, no, let him face the punishment, because it'll build this resilience. Let them face the consequences.
Absolutely.
Again, I mentioned post-traumatic growth. We all know about post-traumatic stress disorder, and that is real. We're all going to have some traumas in our life. I wish it was all Skittles and unicorns, and one of my prayers is you never face a trauma, but it's going to happen. There's this thing called life, and it's either going to get us stuck or we can grow from it. You know, not everybody's going to get post-traumatic stress disorder. And unfortunately, not everybody's going to get post-traumatic growth. But there's some good things that can come from the traumas in our life. And that's, you know, new opportunities can emerge. Relationships get deeper. You get this strength.
I couldn't agree more. I really am a fan of adversity. As much as I bitch about it in my everyday life, I really, truly am a fan of adversity and how it builds strength and character. And it's dangerous, I think, trying to build this utopia of a world where no one's feelings can get hurt and everyone's got to say the right thing to everybody else, because you will eventually, like you said, the thing called life happens, and then you have to be able to be strong and equipped to deal with that. And so I like the resilience that you're talking about isn't a resilience of like, oh, I, you know, read poetry every day and have a strong outlook on being okay inside of who I am. I like that you said it's adversity that builds the resilience.
Oh, it's in the valleys. It's in the valleys of life where we learn the most. Listen, if everything was mountaintops, you wouldn't learn squat.
No.
But it's when in the valleys I learn. It's when I'm down low. It's when I do some self-evaluation. I come out, and no one, I love when people say, oh, Dennis, you need to get over it. You'll never get over it. I'll never get over the loss of Matt.
People say that to you? Which asshole says that to you?
Yeah, exactly. They'll say, get over it. Or, you know, depression, get over it. Just get over it. Smile. Turn that frown upside down. No, yeah, mental health issues. You say, no, I'm going to get through it. And what I look like on the other side, that's why I'm trying to coach people, not how to, if someone's going through a trauma, and we don't get to judge the trauma. It could be something as, you know, complex as the losing of two brothers, or, you know, a job loss, a divorce, a transition in life. Don't want to bring this up with your situation, but in 2016, we had to bury my dog. Oh, and it was horrible.
Yeah.
It's deep, but it's short. Yeah. It's deep. I'll give you, Kristen, I'm going to warn you. It's deep.
Yeah, oh, I know. I'm in it.
It's short. Thank God it's short.
I don't know if it's going to be short.
Well, I'll pray that it's short for you. How about that? We'll see what happens. But, you know, we'd love, that was a tough year, 2016. My wife moved out and my dog died. It sounds like a country song now. Like, God, I miss that dog. You know, like, it's like,
now you're really going south. You're singing in the south.
Yeah. God, I miss that dog. Yeah. So it's just try to, and the beautiful thing about resilience is it can be learned and it should be learned and you can work on it. So it's a skill that can be developed. Just Google resilience and there's a lot of studies on there and a lot of good videos on it as well. So it can be a learned skill.
Amazing. Well, then I'm not going to get it because I don't know how to learn shit. But I want you to tell us about the suicide prevention hotline and your experience with that. Because like I said, I picture people on the street to just be these like soulless zombies that have no feelings. And then I picture, you know, being at your lowest point and you're going to call one of those soulless zombies on the suicide prevention hotline. But that's not what it is at all. It's people who are passionate about it and volunteering their time to talk with people who need help, right?
Wonderful group of people. That's because I was an inside in there, often had a story to tell like I had. Wonderful group of dedicated, most of them volunteers, some paid, staffing the lines. The 800-273-TALK or 800-273-8255. If somebody calls that line, and I worked on it when I lived in Chicago, they're actually reaching out. There's this thing called ambivalence. People think they want to die, but they also want to live. And we try to find out the reason why you want to live and dwell on that and talk about that a little bit. That was some of the most wonderful experience of my life, working on the helpline. And people, what would happen on there, Kristen, is I wouldn't say that much. People just needed to talk. I think that's why we have two ears and one mouth. You know, the old expression is you're supposed to listen twice as much as you talk. Those people would call
in. Don't say that because people think I talk too much on this podcast. So let's just minimize that statement.
You have two mouths. It was some of the most rewarding work. And some people, one person one time asked me, he says, Dennis, did you ever talk anyone out of suicide? And I had to sit there and listen to the question. I'm like, you know what? I don't think I ever talked to anyone out of suicide, but I may have listened to somebody out of suicide.
Wow, I love that.
They had the answer, Kristen. They just had to hear it from themselves. And they talked full circle. They got on the phone. It was really bad. And by the time we got off the phone, it was, okay, this is manageable. And they did like 98% of the heavy lifting. I would just sit there and go, tell me more. What else is going on? And they just had to get it out. They just had to get it out.
But if you did have to say more, what would you usually say? Like, would it be generic or really would you tailor it to like, this is this person, this is this human soul, and I'm going to connect with them. I'm not going to give them some generic spiel.
No, you'd often try to, if it was a serious situation, you know, you could always call the police and all that stuff and do a well check. Or you just try to talk about, you know, disarming the plan. There's some strategies. You know, what are you thinking about? Oh, I've got all these pills. But what if you gave those pills to someone to hold until we get through this? You know, try to get planned. And then you always try to find out, well, you know, and you hear a dog bark in the background. Like, hey, what's your dog's name? You know, hey, who's going to take care of the dog when you're gone? You know, Diversion and trying to get them to look at the positive aspects of life. And we used to do this. I don't think they do it anymore. It's been a while since I've been on the helpline. We used to make these contracts with people. And now the big push is, you know, for safety planning. You know, you should have a safety plan and fill it out when you're well. But we used to do these contracts where we'd say, listen, can you make me a deal tonight? Let's not do anything tonight. Can we talk tomorrow? And get them through the day. What happened for most people in that suicidal crisis, the logic was, you know, it's a short-term event. Let's get them to the other side. Let's talk them through it and get on the other side. You know, for some people, suicide is always on the menu. It's always an option, which is sad, but it's true. But for most people, they're in that mode and they'd say, well, suicide, people say suicide is a, you know, permanent solution to temporary problems. But the people in that crisis cannot see the temporariness of it. We can on the outside, but they can't. So we just have to guide them through that process and listen, what does this look like? You know, tell me about the dog that's barking in the background and just get them to talk a little bit. And the more they talked, the smaller their problems seemed. And it was, people just need to sometimes to vent.
This is where I'm not going to get emotional, but this is where my guilt comes in for Stevie. We were supposed to tape the day that she left us. That day we were supposed to tape two episodes of our podcast and I had to cancel because I had to work because rent was due. And I, to this day, know that if I didn't cancel taping those episodes, she wouldn't have done it. Maybe she would have done it another day, but she wouldn't have done it that day. And that sits with me so heavy all the time, constantly. So, you know, that's something that I have to work through. But yeah.
Are you working through that with a professional? Are you working through that with a professional? Because one of the suicide survivors is, I have the right not to feel responsible for their suicide debt. That's right number two. And I felt it too. You know, you're talking to a guy who lost two brothers. What could I have done? What should I have seen? What did I see? I'm only here to tell you that as time goes on, you'll feel less and less of that. God rest her soul, but Stevie did what Stevie did to Stevie. And it's sad.
Yeah, and it's so sad. But like you said, with it being like in the crisis mode, I think she wouldn't have been in that crisis mode if we had been spending the day together. And it's like that crisis mode is so critical, but you know, I didn't know it was happening or that it was there. So I can't really say, oh, well, I should have, you know, intervened. But just knowing that, like, if she was just distracted enough that day, and I think, like you were saying, with the, you ask who's going to take care of the dogs, who's, you know, you kind of snap them out of it. I just wish that we were able to tape so that I could have snapped her out of it. And I know, like you said, Stevie made her own decision and I'm not responsible for it, but it's like that, what if, like, what if I had worked harder the week before so I had earned enough money for rent and didn't have to work that day, you know, like, and then I reflect on, well, I was probably being lazy and, you know, and then I get mad at myself for that, but that, yes. And I should be talking to a professional, but I'm not, and I will be eventually, but I'm not at this moment.
You should work that through, because, you know, it's the old adage, you know, if grandma had a penis, she'd be grandpa. Hopefully you can unpack this with a therapist and get through that, the right not to feel responsible for the suicide death, because that's what happens in a suicide, Chris. And it comes with this baggage. It doesn't, like, if my brothers were hang gliding and got hit by lightning, you know, maybe it'd be easier for me. You know, they died by suicide. So it comes with this stuff. And the only thing I can tell you, as a guy who's going to, you know, lost a brother in 83 and then in 94, is time has an amazing way of healing. And it, you do whatever you got to do to get better. But time is your friend here. It's your asset. And that's why I feel so bad when people are going through something and they die by suicide. They throw away one of their best assets, time. Time on this planet, like you talked about, the 80 years we get, as you get further and further removed from the situation through time, it seems to be smaller and smaller. So as you get further and further away from Stevie's death and you go seek professional help, you'll feel less responsibility. It just happened. It just, you had to cancel, you had to pay rent. These things happen. So it's my thought and prayer that you find somebody to work through that with, because it's in the end, Matt, Mark, Stevie made a decision and it devastated us all. We really wish they would have consulted us on it.
Absolutely. Well, like you just said, when you get older, the further removed you are from it, it seems less huge and easier. I think that's why I love old people. I've always, since I was like 6 years old, I've wanted to hang out with people in a nursing home over kids my own age.
They don't get frazzled very easily. They've seen it. And the reason they're like that, life has happened to them. Some of those people in those nursing homes have buried children. You know, they've seen the worst.
Right. One time in a nursing home, funny little side story, I went with a friend of mine to see her grandmother for her grandmother's, like, you know, I don't know, 90th birthday or something. And we were only, I think, maybe 11 or 12. But when we were there, a woman had, it was her birthday and she was turning 100, and she stood up from her wheelchair and she said, I'm 100 today, and took down her pants and underwear. And that was the best moment I've ever experienced in my life.
Well, there you go.
Just a 100-year-old woman pulling down her pants in front of us.
There's a life goal for
like,
you.
That was awesome. Exactly. That's why I love old people. They don't care.
That's a life goal. Write it down, Chris. And when I turn 100, I'm dropping my drawers. Yeah.
Hopefully I can still have enough coordination to even be able to drop them. But so with the suicide hotline or suicide lifeline, because I've made jokes before about how it's good. I'm glad it's not hotline, because hotline's too like, hey, we're calling the hotline. It's things are booming over here at the hotline. Come and get yours at the hotline. You know, like I've read it as lifeline. I think that just sounds a little better.
Suicide Prevention Lifeline.
What's the number?
It's 800-273-8255. Or 800-273-TALK. Yeah.
Can't they just make it like 123? So the last thing you have to worry about is Googling a phone number, you know?
We are working on that. It's so funny you said that. I've been lobbying in DC on this behalf, and we're working towards getting a 3-digit number, like a 611 number for
yeah,
that.
Yeah, like what the heck?
Keep your fingers crossed.
I will. And I think it's just so it's just not logical. You know, someone's in the depths of despair. Let's give them the most complicated phone number and hope they'll remember it.
Stand on 1 foot, dial 800-273, yeah, 8255, and then hop, and we'll connect you through. No, they're working on it as we speak. Common sense is not too common, and this should have been done years ago, but we're working on it.
Common sense.
Exactly. And you could also use a text line, by the way.
Oh, yeah. And that's so awesome that they're doing that. And, I think, like I just said, I love old people. I think like an old person, because I wouldn't even imagine there'd be a text line for that. But of course there is. It's 2018, almost 19. And sorry if you're hearing noise. It's my dog. Of course there would be text. That's the way of the future. And I love that you can simply, because I think people probably get scared to speak about it too sometimes.
You know what this comes in handy? The text line comes in handy like in a dorm situation, or the good folks at the homeless shelter. They can't use their phones at night for verbal or audio calls, but they can text. So if you text home to 741-741, a trained counselor will answer your text. So that's really cool.
Yeah, that's awesome. I love that. Well, this has been very informative. You are such an amazing soul. Like, you're just like, I can tell, a great person. And not just because you've been so patient with doing this show 5 times, but because of many other reasons. And before we wrap up the show, we're going to do some segments. And so the first one we're going to do is schizophilmia, but I'm going to replace philmia with the word bookia, so schizobookia. The Misfits Manifesto by Lydia Yuknovich. It's such a good, honest book about being a misfit, but it's like she calls it a love story for misfits. So she's telling you why it's okay to be a misfit and how to use it to your advantage, and why we make the world such a great place. And if we all fit in, how boring the world would be. And so if anyone feels like a misfit, and I mean, I'm not super far into the book, but so far I'm really enjoying it. And that's called The Misfits Manifesto.
The Island of Misfit Toys from Rudolph. Everybody should watch it.
I know. I really am ashamed of myself, because I'm a big Christmas nerd and I love Christmas movies. But Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, I have not seen since I was probably 12. So I'm disappointed. But anyway, okay. Next segment, Cooking with Carney. And this is where I talk about something pathetic that I've eaten when I'm really down in the dumps.
Yep.
And I told you it was Cheetos with red pepper hummus. Have you tried it yet? I remember when we talked, you said it actually did sound kind of good.
It sounded really good. I have not, I swear this is terrible. I have not been food shopping since we talked last. I got nothing in my house. I've been eating out terribly.
How are you even alive?
The holidays came and I just started going out and eating.
Right. Okay.
My son came over. I have nothing in the fridge. It's horrible.
Oh, yeah. That's bad. But it's good you don't have Cheetos in your house. That's a good thing. So don't buy the Cheetos, but do get hummus, because obviously hummus is good for you. And I know you mentioned recently about like not eating sugar. So I have a feeling you won't do the Cheetos with the hummus. But it's quite delicious, surprisingly. But the problem is with the Cheetos is that you have that film on your fingers, and so there's no hiding what you've been doing. It's not like it looks like a carrot from far away, but then you see your fingers close up and it's all orange all over your fingers, and so it's clearly you've been eating Cheetos, not carrots with hummus. So it's slightly embarrassing.
It actually sounds really good. I am going to do that.
What is your go-to kind of gluttonous food or gross food or delicious gross food?
No, it's funny, this is me being an old fart. I have a crock pot, and no matter what I throw in the crock pot, as long as I have a a jar of salsa. It goes in there with it, no matter what it is.
Oh my God, yes.
Just empty the salsa in the crock pot and then let it go. And whatever it is, it tastes awesome. The salsa makes it awesome. It's so simple.
That's so true.
Just dump it in, even a frying pan. Just put salsa in there. Just go. Whatever
you
have.
I don't know why I don't have a crock pot. I'm such a crock pot type because I'm so lazy that I, you know, that is calling my name a crock pot. Would be my crack pot, essentially.
Yeah, exactly. It's the crock pot is like awesome for me. I have ADD and I forget, like I forget that I put it on, go out and work, come back. I'm like, oh, it's like Christmas. Like, oh, I have dinner tonight.
Yeah.
Because you're like, oh my gosh, I forgot I did that. Yeah. And it smells like something with some kind of meat with salsa is in the crock pot.
Yeah, that's what I'm going to do. Okay. And so the last segment is one that Stevie and I had done from the beginning. And I want to end this show because technically this is the last Mentally Chill podcast. There will be more podcasts coming with under a different name, but I want to end it with a segment that Stevie and I would always do, which is called Who's Sadder? And you're going to help me debate and compare and contrast who is sadder. So for this week's Who's Sadder, we are comparing YouTube commenters or Yelp commenters. Who's sadder between the two?
I'm going to go with the YouTube commenters because at least the Yelp folks maybe have been in the restaurant or they've been there or done something. They got out of their house or apartment and visited the site. But the YouTube, you're just doing it.
I'm so mad at you because that was going to be my debate. That was going to be my side. Damn.
All right. Well, where were you going?
Well, no, I was going to say at least Yelp commenters leave the house.
That's it. That's perfect. I think we agree.
Yeah, I do. I know, but I'd like to have more fun.
We can agree. You want to debate it?
I do. So I'll just say it real quick. The Yelp commenters, the thing about them is I think they're more petty than YouTube commenters. So I think YouTube commenters are sadder, but Yelp commenters are pettier.
I agree with you there. They do. They do. They'll pick it apart. And the little thing, like the parsley was on the left side instead of the right side. Yeah. They'll look for little things.
Totally. It's like the guy who takes away a dollar from a waitress's tip every time she doesn't, you know, look at him the right way. But then YouTube commenters, it's just like I a long time ago wanted to shoot a sketch of YouTube comments, but in real life, in a like a funny way. And then actually I saw someone kind of did the same thing, but they did it in like a sad way. But like imagine just going up to some like adorable girl singing with a guitar and just being like, you're ugly, and then walking away. You know, it's so pathetic.
I think we could do away with all this stuff if the internet required a real picture of you, your real name, and your cell phone number, and then you're allowed to comment.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
No more of this anonymity.
100%. Whatever. Anyway. Well, thank you so much for doing this and for speaking so candidly and honestly about something so traumatic and troubling that you've turned into something very positive. And tell people how they can find out more about you.
Sure. It's real simple. My name is Dennis Gillen, and that's the name of my website, DennisGillen.com. I'm on the book face as well, Instagram, and what else? My Twitter. My kids tell me I'm too old to do Snapchat, so I'm not there. So between those three, I think the website's got some cool stuff. It's got a personal safety plan you could download and the top 10 warning signs. And I'd love to come speak wherever you are. So find me, go on my website, say, hey, we're looking for a speaker. Anywhere and anywhere. I've spoken at gyms, coliseums, you name it, restaurants, bars. I'll do it as long as we can talk about, you know, spreading a good message of hope, looking at the warning signs and taking a real good swipe at the stigma that's associated with mental illness, because there should be no stigma.
I love it.
Mental illness.
And this is what you're doing full time.
Full time, all the time, anywhere and everywhere.
That's so amazing. Well, you called yourself an old fart a couple times on the show. And so since you're self-deprecating yourself, I'm going to jump on you with the old fart thing. I know you're an old fart because I don't know if you know this, and I don't know if your sons have told you this, but you have your read receipts on your iPhone. And that's like a sign of an old person. Did you know your read receipts on?
I did not. That is a classic.
Yeah.
I don't know how to turn it off.
I know. Well, it's adorable. Whenever I see someone with the read receipts on, I'm like, oh, that's so cute. And then I don't really want to say anything in case like your sons enjoy knowing when you've read their message. And I, you know, wouldn't want them to lose that access and have you shut it off. But my dad just got an iPhone, and not that you're nearly my dad's age whatsoever, but he just got an iPhone, and I was like, should I leave his read receipts on? Should I not? I went through the debate. I turned him off for his sake, for his dignity. But anyway, yeah, turn your read receipts off and you'll be 20 years younger.
There you go. I got a tip for the day. Now, if I knew how to do it, I'd do it, but I'll ask my kids.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, and stay in touch. And I'm so honored to have you as the last guest for the Mentally Chill podcast.
Well, I think I'm honored to be on this, Kristen, and I appreciate all the work you're doing. Keep it up.
I will. And for everyone else listening, remember, stay sad enough to listen, but not too sad. Bye, guys.